All right, you guys. Welcome to the show. It's already Friday again, right? Yeah. Good times. All right. It's going to be a good show today. I got Sheldon Richmond and Jacob Hornberger, both from the Future Freedom Foundation. I've got Nadia Kayali. Kayali? I think it's Kayali. I need to put a line over the A. That way I remember it's a long A, the first A there. Kayali. Isn't that right? Isn't that what she said? And Ray McGovern's going to be here too. So that's going to be cool. Yeah. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. Thanks for listening. My website is scotthorton.org. 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 You can find all my interview archives there, my whole show archives. You can find my blog. Links to, you can find all my articles there. You can find a collection of documentaries I put together that you might want to look at. Not that I made any of them, but just I put the collection of other people's documentaries together. And you can join up the chat room at scotthorton.org/chat. And yeah, and you can patronize my sponsors by clicking on their links right there in the right-hand column. They like it when you do that. scotthorton.org. All right, good. Okay, now, I don't know. I guess I'm going to, first of all, I'm going to go through the headlines here at antiwar.com. And then I'll only have one more segment to tell you what I think it means, at least so far, before we get to the interviews. But obviously, the reinvasion of Iraq is top of the list today. On CNN just now, they had attack on Iraq. Or no, it was Iraq under attack. U.S. forces to arrive tomorrow. Oops. No, I mean, we're going to help them. They're under attack by, you know, some other guys, and we're there to protect them from being attacked. Yeah. All right, well, anyway, same difference. Obama sends 300 troops as advisors to Iraq, and of course, there's 275. Mostly Marines, but I think some Army going to the embassy. Then there's another 300 Special Forces, Navy SEALs, and Rangers, at least, according to Barbara Starr, Pentagon spokesperson, pretend journalist at CNN yesterday. And I think it was something I read by Tom Englehart that said, no, because he's way older than that. Who was it that I read that talked about growing up in an era when just advisors was a punchline? Where am I plagiarizing that from? I just read it last night. Boy, when I was growing up after Vietnam era, just advisors was a punchline. He could also said, yeah, and it wasn't a war either. It was just a police action too. That's how I grew up too. Just advisors, huh? Yeah. In other words, war. War with euphemisms. Okay, good. Advisors get scare quotes in the top headline at antiwar.com today. Obama sends 300 advisors. And then U.S. airmen on standby to launch Iraq air war. U.S. military advisors also fight, history tells us. I guess that should be the second one. Well, not really. Dems starting to unite around President Obama on Iraq. Yeah, exactly. You know, I saw some tweet yesterday. It was just too true. Democrats waiting to see what Obama does on Iraq to decide what they think Obama should do on Iraq. Their opinion pending his activity. At which point, they will decide that they agree with him. It really is disgusting, isn't it? And I don't just mean the politicians, I mean the people who love them too. It's just gross. Anyway, Maliki says he will not quit. Now, that was Patrick Coburn had sources. I really should have started the show with this yesterday. Patrick Coburn has Iraqi sources telling him this, and the Wall Street Journal has American sources, and this is from yesterday. saying that Obama wanted Maliki gone and he'll give aid as long as Maliki gets out. It's all his fault, apparently. Which, of course, is largely true, but still. Who put him there? America did. The U.S. government did. But anyway, so Obama wants him gone. He denied that yesterday in the, statement slash press conference thing. Just how you know that that's exactly what he wants. Oh, it's not up to us to pick Iraq's leaders. Oh, really? That's funny, because I seem to remember history and stuff where, previous governments certainly had picked Iraq's leaders, and Obama certainly has no problem picking leaders anywhere else in the world, so rang a little hollow there. But Wall Street Journal says, and it's plausible, that they want Maliki to go, but then what kind of idiocy is that? Man, I saw Basevich on TV saying, yeah, you know, Jack Kennedy thought it'd be a great idea to shoot DM in the head, too. Oh, no, he was mortified that DM died. Oh, he died in the coup? Oh, no. History records JFK is saying, oh, he died. Oh, I never meant for that to happen. Anyway, they overthrew DM because DM sucks, and that's why we're losing the war over there. It's because this DM guy is no good. No wonder the people of South Vietnam aren't loyal to him. We should replace him with the other guy. And then the other guys, they were just as bad or worse. And, of course, the entire strategic Hamlet thing was straight out of Stalin's 5-year plan. How could that have possibly done anything but make enemies out of the entire population of South Vietnam? Give me a break. The whole thing is madness. I digress. They got rid of DM, and then everything got worse, not better. They're going to get rid of Maliki. Who are they going to replace him with? Maliki is the compromise between the Supreme Council for Islamic Revolution in Iraq and Muqtada al-Sadr, the two major leaders of Shiite factions that have their own armies. And they decided, you know what would help us get along is if we appointed a guy from the Dawah Party that doesn't have its own army as kind of a compromise between your side and my side. Let's do that. Oh, you know whose idea that was? Iran's. And then Condoleezza Rice came and put a rubber stamp on it. And so they put Maliki in there. Who's better from Dawah? They started out with Jafari. They replaced him. They couldn't stand Jafari, so they replaced him with Maliki. But again, for the 1,000,000,000th time on this show, like I've been telling you since, and bringing reporters on to tell you since way back in 2004, 2005, certainly Bob Dreyfus was saying this all along. America, George Bush and his guys decided that of all the different Shiite factions, they would support the Supreme Council for Islamic Revolution in Iraq. And those were the guys who were most interested in doing what Iran wanted, which was not to rule the unruly Sunni triangle, was to take Baghdad and keep the South. You can go back and read about these debates back in 2004 and 2005. Sadr is a nationalist. Sadr wants to form a government of national salvation, he calls it, with the Sunni Arabs. Iraq for Iraqis of all sects. Kick Iran and America out. And the Americans gamble, assuming they were even smart enough to know what the hell was going on at all, their gamble was, we're going to back the pro-Iran factions that Iran wants us to back, but by the end, we will be the ones with more influence than Iran. And then that didn't work. But that's who they chose to back, was the Supreme Council for Islamic Revolution and the Dawah Party, for that matter, both of whom had much more interest in doing what Iran wanted in creating a little, Eastern Arab Shiistan than in holding Iraq together. This conflict is the fruit of that bad policy. Hey, all, Scott Horton here for The Future Freedom, the monthly journal of the Future Freedom Foundation. As you may already be aware, Jacob Hornberger, Sheldon Richmond, and James Bovard are awesome. They're also in every issue of The Future Freedom, and they're joined by others of the best of the libertarian movement. People like Anthony Gregory, Wendy McElroy, Lawrence Vance, Joe Stromberg, and many more. Even me. Sign up for The Future Freedom at fff.org/subscribe. It's just $25 a year for the print edition, $15 to read it online. That's The Future Freedom, edited by Sheldon Richmond at fff.org/subscribe. And tell you heard it here. All right, I'm here. I'm just writing an angry tweet about how much I hate the stupid Pope. Stupid Pope. The Pope is a damned fool. See, I'm at my character limit. The Pope is a damned fool. Send the Atlanta Drug Task Force SWAT team after him and those he loves best and see how he likes it then. It's a little wordy, I admit. Well, I'll get to it at the break. Well, the Pope says that drug addiction is evil. Therefore, marijuana should be illegal. Oh, wow. You thought that out really well, Pope. I hate your guts. Therefore, you should be banned forever from speaking. And if you talk, the SWAT team ought to kick in your door in the middle of the night. Because I don't like the things that you say. Because the things that you say are evil. You damned stupid Pope. How intelligent do you have to be a Pope? Isn't there some kind of rule where you gotta have at least a lukewarm kind of IQ? Hey, little kids getting raped in juvenile prison because they smoked a little pot and got caught up in the system. Is that an evil, Pope? Or you're just jealous of the guards in that case, huh? I can't believe anybody listens to any Pope in the 21st century. And I'm sorry if you're Catholic. I'm not sorry if you're offended. I'm just sorry that you're Catholic to directly plagiarize the great Bill Hicks. And I'm really anti all religion. And I don't usually go all Bill Maher about it because I hate the state and I don't get all bent out of shape about people's personal beliefs. You know, you have your faith. I don't want to quarrel with you about what you believe, but you believe in this man? This dipshit. This scumbag. He calls himself a pope, and you're supposed to respect him? This guy who's just proven for a fact that he doesn't know his ass from a hole in the ground? Oh, you know, I'm the pope, and I think that I don't like it when people smoke pot, so I think it should be illegal because I'm magic, and I speak for God on earth and his will. And God would have a war on drugs, and God would never weigh the cost and the benefits of a public policy like that, and God would never take into account natural rights theory and whether men have the right to actually make bad decisions for their own lives. Is it up to us to choose whether we believe or not? Does that decision belong to us? We need another reformation to get that settled? Who are these crazy people who would listen to a pope who would support a war on drugs? What kind of sick monster? I mean, if you support the war on drugs, then you're just some stupid jerk. But so what? But this guy's the freaking pope. So, people listen to him. People change their mind just because he's the one who said what they ought to think now. And I know that he's supposedly infallible on issues of biblical, etc., and not on every public policy issue. But followers conflate those things. This guy is supposedly the most magical of all of the priests of the Catholic Church. And he goes around saying stuff like this. Keep drugs illegal because addiction is awful. Oh yeah, compared to what? Maybe a soldier who couldn't hear John Paul's silent cry against the Iraq war might have, you know, joined up in good faith and have PTSD from all the innocent people that he killed and seeing his best friend torn to pieces in the aluminum Humvee next to him. And so now maybe smoking pot all day is how he doesn't kill himself, Pope. Is it evil now, you stupid piece of crap, Pope? Give me a break, a Pope. I don't know. I just can't put... I try so hard to put myself in other people's shoes, but I just can't understand how anyone would listen to a thing that a Pope says about anything. Yeah, John Paul was technically against the Iraq War. Could have stopped it in an instant, but didn't. Right? He didn't issue a giant, you know, directive with force and do what he could. You know, with force, I mean, on the members of the Catholic community that they would be bound to follow, or that church leadership would be bound to follow. He went, oh, yeah, the Iraq War. Yeah, no, you shouldn't do that. Yeah, thanks a lot, dude. One guy could have stopped the war with his word. And wanted to, but just couldn't be bothered to. And this Pope, they say, this is the nice one. The one who would have little kids locked up and raped in juvie for having a little pot. You know, because addiction is bad. Right? He gets to do as much mathematics on his public policy decisions as the average soccer mom. Well, I don't like it, and so it should be illegal. Yeah, great. Maybe you should go to hell. Anyway, sorry to be so distracted, but honestly, look at the lives destroyed by the war on drugs in America alone. Never even mind America's foreign policy in the name of the war on drugs around the world. In Latin America, where the Catholics live, for example. But just look at this country, the lives destroyed. It's like an entire Iraq war on our own soil. And never even mind heroin or cocaine. I'm not even talking about that. I'm not even talking about the people doing life for being a hippie and selling another hippie some acid or whatever crap. But just the war on pot is like the Iraq war worth of evil in our own country. Over pot? Are you kidding me? Have you ever seen pot before? I don't know. Sorry. I just absolutely cannot abide it anymore. How could anybody be so wrong-headed about something so simple? Damned idiot Pope. Yeah, I'm sure Jesus would send SWAT teams around to kill people on the suspicion that they might be involved in the drug trade. You know, you gotta look real carefully, but that's right in between the lines of the Sermon on the Mount. Seek out recreational drug users and drug businessmen and crush them! It's right there, if you squint. That's what Jesus is, number one representative on earth, thinks. Supposedly. Sorry, I know I should have spent that time talking about Iraq and Syria and whatever, but man, it's got to be said. Interviews coming up. Sheldon Richmond next. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here to tell you about this great new book by Michael Swanson, The War State. In The War State, Swanson examines how Presidents Truman, Eisenhower, and Kennedy both expanded and fought to limit the rise of the new national security state after World War II. If this nation is ever to live up to its creed of liberty and prosperity for everyone, we are going to have to abolish the empire. Know your enemy. Get The War State by Michael Swanson. It's available at your local bookstore or at Amazon.com in Kindle or in paperback. Just click the book in the right margin at scotthorton.org or thewarstate.com. Hey, y'all, Scott here. First, I want to take a second to thank all the show's listeners, sponsors, and supporters for helping make this show what it is. I literally couldn't do it without you. And now I want to tell you about the newest way to help support the show. Whenever you shop at Amazon.com, stop by ScottHorton.org first and just click the Amazon logo on the right side of the page. That way the show will get a kickback from Amazon's end of the sale. It won't cost you an extra cent. And it's not just books. Amazon.com sells just about everything in the world except cars, I think. So whatever you need, they've got it. Just click the Amazon logo on the right side of the page at ScottHorton.org or go to ScottHorton.org/Amazon.
All right, you guys.
I'm Scott Horton, and this is my show, The Scott Horton Show. And our first guest on the show today is our good friend Sheldon Richmond, Vice President of the Future Freedom Foundation and editor of their journal, The Future Freedom. His TGIF today is called The Middle East Harvests Bitter Imperialist Fruit. Indeed. Welcome back to the show. Sheldon, how are you doing? Oh, I hit the wrong damn button. Now tell me how you're doing.
I'm doing great.
I always do that. The first Skype call of the day, I always hit the phone button, but that's all right. Hey, great article here. I'm going to shut up and let you tell the story.
Well, thank you. Yes, it's a story that actually has been told a lot. There are many books and articles that have been written over the years, but I wanted to tie it into what we're witnessing today in Iraq and Syria and the Middle East generally. And it tells the story of how during World War One, the Great Britain and the French, mostly Great Britain was pushing this, wanted to hurt the effort of the Turks, the Ottoman Empire, to help Germany and the Austro-Hungarian Empire. And so they went to the Arabs. The Ottoman Empire ruled the Arab world in those days. The Arabs weren't necessarily happy about that, but the British went to them, or went to their leaders, the people who were regarded as leaders, and said, we'll make a deal with you. If you revolt against the Turks, we will make sure you have independence at the end of the war. And they made a few exceptions. There were some areas of what is today Lebanon. They said the French had an interest in, and the English had an interest in Baghdad, actually, and Basra in southern Iraq. But they said generally the rest of it will be yours to govern, and we'll just leave you alone. So that was a nice promise, and it was taken up. It was accepted by the Arabs. There was correspondence between the British High Commissioner in Cairo. The British had, of course, occupied and ruled Egypt since the 19th century. So there was correspondence between the Sharif Hussein, who was one of the leaders of the Arabs, and certainly one of the most head of one of the most prominent families, the Hashemites. So between McMahon, the High Commissioner, and Hussein, they had an understanding in a series of letters written in 1915 and 16, asserting that Arab independence would be respected after the war, assuming England won the war. So this is the famous story of Lawrence of Arabia. A lot of people have probably seen the movie, and while that might not have been totally historically accurate, there's a lot of controversy around Lawrence. That's generally what happened. He and other Brits went there and led Arab forces to disrupt the Turks' war effort, blowing up railroad tracks and attacking Aqaba which is between Israel and Egypt, and really hassling the Turks. But the key thing here is the British never had any intention of keeping its promise to the Arabs. And around this same time, 1916, the English and the French, along with the Russians at the time, still ruled by the Tsar, were negotiating an agreement about how they would divvy up the Middle East after the war. This was known as the famous Sykes-Picot agreement. Mark Sykes and François-Georges Picot, British diplomats and so-called experts in the Middle East, sat down and basically carved things up. Russia was still in the war then, and so Russia was going to get a piece of what is today the Republic of Turkey. Syria was going to get, France was going to get Greater Syria, which includes what's now Lebanon. Britain would get a good bit of Mesopotamia, namely Iraq, and some ports on the Mediterranean. So those were the best developed parts of the Arab world, and that's what was going to be given to be taken by the French and the British. The greater part of the Arabian Peninsula, what we know today as Saudi Arabia and Yemen, was undeveloped, and its oil potential was not had not yet been discovered. And so they kind of said to each other, we'll give that to the Arabs. They can have that. We'll rule the rest of it. So they took what they thought was the best part of it. This was a secret. Obviously, it was a secret because if you've made a promise of independence to the Arabs, you're not going to want this published. You at least want to wait until late, until the war's over and you got your troops there to enforce your will. But one little thing happened that was not anticipated by the French and the English, namely the Bolsheviks. By then the Russians had left the war. There was, the Tsar was overthrown. Then they had this provisional government, which stayed in the war and which enabled the Bolsheviks, which was a rather small segment, have their own revolution in the fall of 1917. They overthrow the Kerensky provisional government and take over. And one of the, in my view, the only decent thing that Lenin did in his whole adult life, I suppose, was to discover the Sykes-Picot agreement telegrams and whatnot in the Tsar's records and release it to the world to embarrass the English and the French. And well, that was a little bit earlier than the French and the English wanted it exposed, but the Arabs were already sort of fully in. There was nothing much they could do about it at that point. And so things went ahead. And then, the Sykes-Picot agreement, the terms of that agreement were modified in various ways through other agreements, through changes in the world situation, namely the Bolshevik revolution and later conferences in 1920, like San Remo and Italy. They did some modifications. And it ended up with, pretty close to Sykes-Picot, but some differences. So, England gets what they created Iraq out of Mesopotamia. They created the new state of Iraq. The French got Syria and created Lebanon, and Palestine was to be which was originally supposed to be internationally supervised, became a what they called a mandate, which was their euphemism for colony. In fact, they were all colonies. They just didn't use the term anymore. They thought, well, here in the 20th century, 19th century colonialism isn't going to fly. So they changed. They used words like protectorate and mandate. And so England got Palestine and they separated Jordan as a separate state. It was called Transjordan at that point, and later just plain Jordan. And they created states. They just created states. They drew lines through religious sects, like separating, sometimes dividing sects, like, Sunnis or Shiites, just draw an arbitrary line in the sand, bisecting tribes and ethnic groups, like the Kurds. The Kurds are sort of scattered around. Kurdistan could be a sort of a contiguous area, but at the moment, it's parts of three or four different states, including Iran and Turkey. And so they decide, they're just colonial planners creating states out of whole cloth without any regard for the people. They never asked the people. They were not involved in any of the conversations or conferences or anything. It was just the colonial mindset that we know better, we're civilized, they're savages. Maybe someday they might have said in some theoretical frame of mind, they'll be ready for self-government. But for the time being, we know best. Meanwhile, so they were lying to the Arabs. They made a promise they never intended to keep. Meanwhile, in 1917, before Palestine had been conquered, the Balfour Declaration is issued, mm-hmm. in which the king of England is saying that he looks with favor on the creation of a Jewish national home in Palestine, which created more headaches.
Right. Well, now the music's playing and we got to take this break. But yes, when we get back, we'll talk more about how everything wrong in the world is Woodrow Wilson's fault with the great, and the British and the French, with the great Sheldon Richmond, FFF.org. Admit it, our public debate has been reduced to reading each other's bumper stickers. Scott Horton here for LibertyStickers.com. I made up most of them, and most of those when I was mad as hell about something. So if you hate war, empire, central banking, cops, Republicans, Democrats, gun grabbers, and status of all stripes, go to LibertyStickers.com, and there's a good chance you'll find just what you need for the back of your truck. own a bookstore, sell guns at the show, get the wholesaler's deal. Buy any 100 stickers and they drop down in price to a dollar a piece. You can spread the contempt and make a little money too. That's LibertyStickers.com. Everyone else's stickers suck. Me. Welcome back. I'm Scott. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. I'm on the Liberty Radio Network. ScottHorton.org. Talking with the great Sheldon Richman from the Future Freedom Foundation. FFF.org/subscribe for the Journal of the Future Freedom, which he edits, which I ought to write for if I wasn't so busy and lazy. All right, we're talking about his great article today, The Middle East Harvests Bitter Imperialist Fruit. And it's about, the British and the French having their way with the former Ottoman Empire at the end of World War I. And I have to point out here that if Woodrow Wilson had not got America into World War I, then the war would have ended as a stalemate rather than a total victory for the British and the French, who were then able to dictate all these terms, and the British Empire was able to expand by a million square miles. And, you know, other things would have happened instead. I don't know, but boy, oh boy, it didn't have to be that way. And so not only can we blame the rise of Nazi Germany and even the rise of the Soviet Union on Woodrow Wilson's intervention in World War I, but also all the consequences in the Middle East as well. And where we left off at the break was this promise from Lord Balfour to Lord Rothschild that, yes, the English will support the creation of a homeland for the Jews in Palestine.
Right. And, you know, like, you have to look at that as part of the whole picture. I mean, it fits in with Sykes-Picot. The main question is, by what right or authority or power, or I guess power, if you put it in terms of power, it answers itself. But by what authority does the British dispose of Arab lands? I mean, it's Arab occupied land. They've been there a long time. They worked the soil. They grew farms. They had towns and villages. I mean, it belonged to the Arabs. I don't mean in a collective sense. I mean in an individual John Locke sense. By what right does the English say, or the British say, yeah, we're going to create states here. We're going to put, you know, you on the throne of one country and you on the throne of another country. I mean, this is what they did. They picked out members of the Hashemite family and said, okay, you're the king of Iraq and you're the king of Jordan. And then they said to the Zionist movement, they didn't get very specific at this point. They said, we look with favor on the formation of a national home for the Jewish people, and we'll do everything possible to bring it about. And then they throw in like boilerplate. And by the way, nothing about this is to prejudice the rights of the other people there. I like how they refer to the Arabs, the other people there. They were at least 85% of the population of Palestine. And they threw in, and Jews in other countries. And the reason they threw that in was because, you know, the Zionist movement had been going on for since the end of the 19th century, and most Jews opposed Zionism. They thought it was a crazy idea. Nobody wanted to go live in the desert or live in Palestine. And so they were making it clear that they feared that their rights in wherever they were now living, like America or other places, would be jeopardized if Palestine was seen to be the official national home of the Jews, because you have questions then of dual loyalty and stuff like that. And they were very nervous about it. Most Jews were not Zionists. That comes later. That comes after World War II. So I think that's why that line ends up in there. But the general point is why, you know, how dared the British and French decide what to do with this land? They didn't live there. It wasn't theirs. They had no authority. They only had their imperial claim, which was the result of military might. And I think decent people will say that's wrong. And it has now bequeathed to us all of these issues. What ISIS and others are doing is, in a way, erasing Sykes-Picot and the San Remo conference and all this other stuff. They're trying to undo this. It's a terrible thing now because it's happening by violence, but we shouldn't be surprised because see what happened. Look, here's the thing. Here's the broadest point of all. The Arabs and the Muslims in that part of the world, they have obviously have sectarian differences. They have other differences, ethnic and whatnot, because, you know, Iranians are Persians. They're not Arabs. All that stuff needed to be worked out without foreign intervention. look, the Christian world had vicious wars, right? In the 16th and 17th centuries. Terrible, terrible wars, 30 years war, you know, of warfare. They didn't have outside intervention. They figured things out, and they finally put that stuff aside, and they try to work things out. And that's what needed that's what the Islamic world needed, but was never allowed because of Western intervention, which began, like I said, in World War I and has never stopped.
Well, I like how you say that too, because it's not necessarily implied that you would really certainly have a separate sovereignty for Mosul, Baghdad, and Basra necessarily. You know, those were the districts under the Ottomans. I've seen a map of, you know, the Levant and Mesopotamia and Arabia that show all the different, you know, what would presumably sort of kind of be the borders. And I don't mean drawn by, you know, Zionists trying to destroy all their Arab enemies. I don't mean those maps, but I mean maps that are more like just, I don't know the term for it, ethnocartographic or whatever the hell, about which sects live here, there, and the other places all through Lebanon and Syria and Iraq. And that's not necessarily, again, where national sovereignties and borders would be drawn, but it does go to show that, you know, how arbitrary it is when the British and the French come in and draw their borders. And really, that's the curse of much of South Asia and all of Africa, even to this day, right?
Well, they drew it for their convenience. You know, I'm not saying it all would have been peaceful if the West had stayed out. I'm not saying everything would have been peaceful. They would have sat down and talked it all out. I'm not saying that. It wasn't true of the Christian world in Europe. It wasn't peaceful. What I'm saying is it would have been more organic and spontaneous. And I think eventually they would have realized violence is not the way to settle things. Much better to not be each other's throats. You know, let's live peacefully, but let's also not shove our religion down the throats of people who don't accept our particular approach to it. They would have eventually discovered that. But what outside intervention does is it radicalizes things, and it gives an advantage to the most extreme, you know, violence-minded people. Because, anybody who seems more moderate is then accused of being an accommodationist, maybe even an agent of the foreign power. And so they are at a disadvantage. Any voice of peace is at a disadvantage internally. And the most radical are at an advantage. And I think we're seeing that today.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, I mean, certainly you can see it in Iraq. And it's... You know, my theory, and I don't state that well because I'm not much of an economist, but I like economists. I'm interested in the things they say. And it all just seems like basically it's the army serves as dollars in a inflated bubble of power for certain groups who wouldn't necessarily have had it. So, for example, just as a thought experiment, never mind how horrible and immoral it is, but if the Americans had somehow zap Saddam Hussein from the sky, but without the regime change and the entire invasion and overthrow and what have you, that the Supreme Islamic Council and the Dawa Party and the Badr Brigades, they might have showed up. Ahmed Chalabi and his guys, they might have showed up. But like you're saying, how it would have really worked out among the power factions, just among the Shia, and then how it would have worked out among the power factions fighting over Baghdad in the fights versus the former Ba'athists and whoever else, jihadis and whoever else, that it would have been a much more organic thing. In other words, not that they would always adopt peace, like you're saying, and everybody would work together, whatever, but whatever resolutions would be much closer to representing natural amounts of power among the leaders of the different factions, compared to having America come in and say, well, you know, Abdulaziz al-Hakim is George Bush's guy, and so we're going to go ahead and do what he and the Ayatollah Khamenei want.
Right, that aggravates things. You also need to keep in mind that over the many years, we're talking about almost 100 years now, August will be the centenary of the beginning of the war, August 4th, 2014. We have to remember that over all that time, you know, the Western powers, particularly the French and the English, would buy off various people and factions to do their bidding. A lot of people are susceptible to living a cushier life and getting some sort of power if they do the bidding of the imperial overseer. And that creates a lot of scores to be settled later on. People have long memories. And so even when the imperialists maybe loosen their grip for whatever reason, maybe they're busy somewhere else or something like that, people then say, well, good, now's my chance to settle the score, to get even with those people that, you know, were bought off by the imperialists and did their bidding and hurt us. Now we're going to go get them. So you see how it fuels future violence that doesn't just stop the moment the imperialists get out. Even if they were to just suddenly say, okay, you're right, we never should have done this, we're leaving, everything doesn't then automatically become peaceful and liberal and, you know, everything that we like. It's right. People still will have grievances and they'll want revenge. So it doesn't, you can't put the, you know, the toothpaste back in the tube very easily.
Right. Well, yeah, I mean, I just think you're absolutely right in that Iraq really shows where, you know, even though it was a fake country that was invented by the British and the French, hey, that was 100 years ago. So yeah, the Iraqi people, they've been through a lot together. And after all, Mosul, Baghdad, and Basra always have been pretty nearby. And so even though they're the Turks and whatever, so there's, you could call it Iraqi civilization. There wasn't, you know, Shia civilization and Sunni civilization there. Maybe there's a little bit more discrepancy when it comes to the Kurds kind of having more of their own thing going on in the north. But and in certain parts of the country, you might have had the percentages a bit different. But it was really the foreign policy of the American occupation that did more than anything to drive the Iraqi people apart. You know what I mean? Even though the dictatorship, the foreign-backed dictatorship under Saddam Hussein, the minority dictatorship, it was a minority dictatorship. I mean, there were Shiites in the Ba'ath Party, but it was dominated by the Sunnis and all that. But the people in general were, you know, have much better attitudes. I don't know. Do you see the thing on Twitter where the husband's sign says, I'm a Shia, and the wife's sign says, I am a Sunni, and the baby's sign says, I am sushi?
Yes, I did see that. So you make a very important point. Once you, after 100 years, you can't just say, oh, let's go back to the way it was before the original intervention, because you're right, a lot has changed. And you're right, even an artificial state will, some sort of nationalism will be developed over 100 years. It's definitely true. And things that you've pointed out, and guests of yours have pointed out, the Shiites in Iraq, lots of the Shiites in Iraq are not terribly fond of Iran, because there are other reasons. They're nationalists. Mm-hmm. They're also Arabs, and the Iranians are not. And so that doesn't mean just because they're Shiite that they want the Iranians to march in and run things either.
Right.
So you can't just say, well, let's go back to, you know, before Sykes-Picot. No, that would be wiping out almost 100 years of events and new generations and thinking, you know, is spontaneously emerges under the new conditions. So there's no way you can say, well, let's restore the conditions. That's impossible, and it would be a disaster to try to do it.
Right. Well, and, you know, I don't know exactly how deliberate it was, you know, in driving the wedge in there under the occupation, but the El Salvador option, it was adopted just under the name of, well, here we got the Bada Brigade is ready to fight already, and they know who the leaders of the Sunni-based insurgency are, who have everything to lose, obviously, if they lose Baghdad and lose their privileged status in the in controlling the government. And but so these Bada Brigade guys can really help us hunt them down. Where, but of course, that was just, again, citing, doubling down on our Bush's bet on the Hakim faction, the Supreme Islamic Council, and that's what really created the civil war. You know, the attacks on Fallujah and the supporting of the El Salvador option, Bada Brigade option on the American side, and then the Al-Qaeda in Iraq response from that is what led to the whole civil war. So I'm not saying it would have been anything like nice at all, but you can just look right at how the Bush policy had just completely distorted the hell out of who had what power and the devastating consequences of those distortions. There's just no doubt about it. So, in other words, your theory proven all the way up to the present day.
Well, I think that's right. I mean, you know, I hardly originated the theory, but lots of people have been writing about this. But unfortunately, they're never the most prominent voices. And the imperial mindset, even if it changes the language, changes the terms, so always seems to be dominant. I don't know why, because people expect the government to be active. I mean, everybody's looking to Bush, to Obama, saying, you know, okay, what are we going to do about this? Well, why do we have to do anything about it? I mean, we helped cause this. We can't, we really can't make things better there, because, you know, bombs aren't going to make things better, and meddling in their politics is also not going to make things better.
All right. Well, thank you very much for your time. It's great to talk to you as always, Sheldon.
My pleasure. Thanks, Scott.
Appreciate it. Everybody, that's the great Sheldon Richmond. He's at fff.org, fff.org/subscribe for the future of freedom. And in just a second, FFF President Jacob Hornberger. Hey, all, Scott here for Liberty.me, the brand new social network and community-based publishing platform for the liberty-minded. Liberty.me combines the best of social media technology all in one place and features nightly classes, guides, events, publishing, and so much more. Sign up now and you get the first 30 days free. And if you click through the link in the right margin at scotthorton.org or use the promo code Scott when you sign up, you'll save $5 per month for life. That's more than a third off the regular price. And hey, once you sign up, add me as a friend on there at scotthorton.liberty.me. Be free. Liberty.me. All right, y'all. Welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. And our next guest is Jacob Hornberger. He's founder and president of the Future Freedom Foundation, the same one that Sheldon is the vice president of. FFF.org is the website. And I'm sitting here scrambling, Jacob. I don't know what the hell happened. I can't find the article that I invited you on to talk about. It doesn't seem to be under your blog heading at fff.org/blog, but I know I was just looking at it the other day, all about the kids being held by the ICE, by the feds down there, for having the temerity to be on the wrong side of a line without the proper paperwork or something terrible like that. Can you please enlighten us and...
Yeah, I think it was an article. It may have been an article we linked to in our FFF Daily rather than an original article that we wrote. Now, I did write an article on May 14th under my blog called Immigration Controls Breed Death and Misery. But in the last couple of days, we've linked to a news article on the whole thing. And it involves this phenomenon of where there's essentially a flood of children, of minors, coming from Latin America, Central America, and Mexico into the United States, illegal aliens, and the Obama administration's plans to deport them all, assuming that they can find them. That they find them, they're going to deport them. And this, of course, is part of the U.S. government's concept of immigration controls, its war on immigrants, the horrible abuse that is being inflicted on people that are just trying to sustain and improve their lives. It's absolutely one of the most horrible moral episodes in U.S. history.
Man, it's really bad, and you know, it's in a kind of just funny way, almost. It goes to show the ridiculousness of socialism and government central planning, where they just don't know what to do, so they just pile them up in a gym, you know, basically just lock them all in a prison. They got no room for them, no ability to care for them or distribute the proper amount of you know, supervision and health care and whatever they need. It's like you know, a normal American could make the parallel to some third world country, like where these kids are from, is what it looks like, where they're being held.
Yeah, your use of the term central planning socialism is very apt. That, you know, you do have aspects of socialist central planning in American society. You've got, like, the Federal Reserve Board. You got public schooling. And Americans like to think of these as free enterprise institutions, but they're the exact opposite. They're the socialist concept of central planning. And immigration controls are the classic example of this. You've got this board of commissars in Washington deciding how many immigrants should enter the United States, which countries they should come from, what their qualifications are. And not surprisingly, as with all socialist structures, you have this total chaos. I mean, Ludwig von Mises called this phenomenon planned chaos. And you have, you know, people crossing borders, smugglers, coyotes as they call them. You have people dying in railroad cars in the back of 18-wheelers. You have them starving or dying of thirst on the deserts. It's just a catastrophic system, and it goes on and on and on. I've seen it since I was a kid. I grew up on the Texas-Mexican border, and I worked with illegal aliens and so forth, and I've seen this for decades. It's just an ongoing crisis, and every so often, like every 5 years, like the five-year-old Soviet socialist planning, they come up with a new crisis, and it requires new immigration, quote, reform, and it never stops. And of course, the state gets bigger and more powerful, and you've got essentially a total militarization of the border. I mean, I grew up down there, and all you see is federal agents everywhere. And the most important thing is, how do you reconcile this with a free society? I mean, to me, it's more reconcilable with a East German type of society or a Cuban type of society than it is with a free society.
All right, now, and I'm sorry, I meant to say too, I'm sorry about the mistake. I could have swore that the article I clicked on was just waiting for me to catch up and read it, but I couldn't find the dang thing in my mess of tabs here. But anyway, I'm glad that you're on top of this. I know that this issue is very important to you, so. And I'm looking at, I guess, at least one of the articles that you linked to here at FFF.org, and in the morning email was to The Guardian about these children being held. And literally piles of them. Just, they're piled in a prison. And by the way, and I don't know all the stats, I know Anthony Gregory can rattle them off, but Barack Obama is far worse on this than any president ever by far in terms of the raw numbers of people being deported, and for the meagerness of the excuses. People who've lived here their entire lives since they were little children, but oh, they got a speeding ticket, or you know, just nonsense, any kind of excuse. And that's no hyperbole. Like, that's at least one of the cases, but I'm sure there are many. Just, I don't know the numbers, but it's hundreds and hundreds of thousands, millions of people being deported by the Obama administration right now. And so I guess you can comment on that, but I also wanted to ask you about who the hell's sending all these kids by themselves over the border? Where
yeah,
are they
that's
coming
interesting.
From? What is this?
That's an interesting question. That for one thing, yes, he is the deporter in chief. I mean, he's breaking all records for deporting people. And the interesting aspect of this is, remember, I grew up on the border when everybody was a Democrat when I was growing up, and so I've heard this all my life about how liberals or progressives love the poor, the needy, and the disadvantaged. And whenever they hear that we libertarians want to dismantle welfare state programs, they say, "Oh, you hate the poor. You hate the poor." And of course, the immigration issue is their big Achilles heel, because they're part of this problem too. Remember, President Obama is a Democrat. He's a progressive. He's a liberal. He professes to love the poor, needy, and disadvantaged, and he'd be the first one to say libertarians are bad people for wanting to abolish welfare state programs, and yet he's the deporter-in-chief, and it's been democratically controlled Congresses throughout the years, and I mean, they've been all part of this problem of waging war against people who have committed what they consider is the dastardly crime of coming to America, trying to find a job, sustain their lives, improve their lives, send money back to their families. And it really goes to show you the total hypocrisy of these people. The numbers, I'm not sure what they are, but yes, they're extremely large. But the real ultimate moral question is why does this go on? Why is it necessary to go on? And the way I look at it is that you don't have to have this kind of system. I mean, our founding fathers had open immigration. I mean, you could come into this country from anywhere, and you had a cursory health inspection, tuberculosis at Ellis Island. But other than that, you were free to come in, no questions asked. In the Southwest, after the U.S. took over the northern half of Mexico, that new border stayed open for, 50 years or so, until the Franklin Roosevelt administration, all the way from 1848 to the 30s. Now, your question is, okay, so how does this happen? Why are there these kids doing it? in it. Well, part of it is that their parents are up here, and they're trying to sustain their lives. I mean, things are so desperate in Latin America that people will do anything to sustain their lives, and of course the lives of their children. But when they're coming across into the United States, it's too difficult to be carrying toddlers. I mean, they're being smuggled in. They can't cross like ordinary human beings, like, you know, with a walking across a bridge or taking the bus north or whatever with their families. So they have to leave their kids behind. And then once they get settled in, they tell the kids, okay, time for you to come up. And so a lot of these kids are like 9, 10 years old, and they risk their lives to come up here. And of course, U.S. officials would say, oh, well, they're just bad people for doing telling their kids this. But
they're illegal.
Exactly. The law puts them in this position.
I'm sorry, but the music's playing, and we got to take this break.
Okay.
When we get back, we're going to be talking more about this crisis with Jacob Hornberger. It's a little bit off topic for the show, the usual subject matter, but a real important one. Something I ought to cover more, too, because it is absolutely a nightmare on the scale that you described there, Jacob. One sec, y'all. We'll be right back. Hey, y'all. Scott Horton here, and I'm so excited about Commodity Discs from CommodityDiscs.com. They're 1 ounce silver pieces with a QR code engraved on the backside. Scan the code with your phone and get the instant spot price. Commodity Discs are paving the way forward for the alternative currency community in America and around the world. The QR code Commodity Disc. Technology has now finally made a real free market silver currency viable. And anyone who donates $100 or more to the Scott Horton Show at scotthorton.org/donate gets one free. That's CommodityDiscs.com. All right, you guys. Welcome back to the show. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. I'm talking with Jacob Hornberger. He's the founder and the president of the Future of Freedom Foundation, and we're talking about the national government's war on little children who dare to cross the border without a permission slip from the empire. When is a little kid a detainee? When he's an immigrant, according to the Associated Press. That's what they are. They're prisoners. I guess they're not charged or convicted of anything, so they're not prisoners. That's a legal term, not just a dictionary definition. So they are detainees, these toddlers, and you know, under 12-year-old children here. It says in at least one of these captions that they reproduce here, 47,000 unaccompanied children have been abducted by the U.S. government. Trying to come into the country since last October. And so now, I guess, well, I don't know what to say, but I don't have a devil's advocate argument for these kids' situation at all. But I'll go ahead and pretend to be a liberal conservative for just a minute here at you, Jacob, and say that no, because they're taking our jobs. Because you libertarians, you're just the shills for big business, and they want to drive down the labor market. You know, they want as loose a labor market as possible, and damn us if we're all unemployed. They don't care about that. They want to keep their costs of hiring people down in all ways, and the more cheap labor, the better. And also, to paraphrase the conservatives, Mexicans! We hate Mexicans! So, what's your answer to that?
Well, the stealing of the jobs thing is standard fare. I mean, I've heard that since I was a kid, and actually, it works the exact opposite. That immigrants are a tremendous economic boon to a society. I mean, Americans ought to be thanking their lucky stars for this gift. That when you look historically at two societies, for example, that have had open immigration, the United States in the 19th century and the Argentinian society at between the 19th and 20th centuries before Perón came into power, they essentially copied the original American system, open immigrations, no income taxes and so forth, no welfare state, and tremendous economic prosperity. And the idea is that immigrants bring a passion for work, a work ethic. They want to work. They're striving to work. There's a dynamism that they bring into a society. And generally speaking, they take the lower echelon jobs, and so in the short term it looks like, oh well, they're displacing American workers. But with the prosperity that the immigrant brings, because remember, he's involved in economic activity. He needs a used car. He needs clothing for his family. He needs food for his family. He needs to find an apartment. That generates new economic activity that then provides jobs for the Americans who are being displaced at the bottom scale. So now Americans are getting better paying jobs, jobs that are more suited to them. They're able to speak English better, which is more important in the higher echelon job. And so you have this perfect system where everybody's benefiting. It may not look like it's a benefit for the guy that's losing a job picking cotton on the fields or something, but when all of a sudden he's hired by the tractor company that's providing tractors for that farm, he's realizing, hey, I'm making more money. There's a better job for me. And this is what happens through the division of labor.
Yeah, but
immigrants infuse that dynamism.
But, Jacob, there are 7 billion people in the world. And I know this is true because I've heard conservatives say it lots of times, that all of them would want to come here. If our government wasn't here to keep them out with fire, they would all move here and take all of our jobs. We'd be washed away and have to go live back where they're from.
Well, that's another popular canard, you know, and it's kind of arrogant because it assumes that everybody really just can't wait to come to the United States. And I remember traveling in Mexico once, and I was living with a family. I was studying Spanish in San Miguel de Allende, and I was asking this guy. He had come to the United States to work, and then had returned home. And I said, well, let me ask you, if the borders were open, you would move? And he said, oh, of course not. He says, I love Mexico. I love my country. I love living down here. And he says, that's the way most people feel. Moving away from your country is a very difficult process. It's the rare person that's willing to risk everything, leave his family, his friends, go to a place where he's going to get insulted and abused and have to work at wages that may be subpar within that particular society. So the fact is, not everyone wants to come to the United States. It's a tough life, when you're on your own and so forth. But it's not something you fear because economically speaking, it can't happen anyway. That as people start to go into an area, prices start to rise. It's supply and demand. Housing starts going up. Food starts increasing. Everything starts going up, and that in itself is a deterrent to more people moving in. I mean, we see this domestically. How many people fear that everybody's going to exit New York and move to Dallas? Well, yes, there are New Yorkers moving to Dallas, but nobody sits here pacing the floors of, oh my gosh, what if everybody from New York suddenly moved to Dallas? Well, we all know what would happen. As more people move in, prices start to rise. Less people start to move in because they realize, hey, I don't want to go into a high-cost area. So it's an old canard that really has no validity whatsoever.
All right, well, I just noticed, and boy, they're pissed off that I just noticed, but somebody's mad in the chat room saying that, well, hit me with some stats then because this is just not right. We've got all this immigration and high unemployment, and you want to pay for all their health and education and welfare too, or who's supposed to, I guess. He must understand that you're not for the welfare state, but we live in one. And so what about all of that? Can you really prove what you're saying, Jacob? Because conservative, maybe, I think, I'm guessing, in the chat room says, hell no.
Well, that's Milton Friedman brought this up. He said, oh, well, as long as you have a welfare state, you can't have open immigration. Well, that's just nonsense. Of course you can. And for one thing, all you have to do is say, look, anybody who's not a citizen doesn't get welfare. Doesn't get public schools. I mean, you actually would be doing them a favor because we all know that public government
right.
schools are a detriment to children, destroys their mind, puts them on Ritalin, makes them good little citizens of the state, conformists and so forth. So the greatest gift you could give to an immigrant is you don't have to go into the government school system, but you could also do the same thing with welfare. In fact, right now, if they have strict rules on immigrants getting welfare and so forth. I mean, I would exempt them from the tax taxes too. It seems only fair that if you're not going to give them these welfare benefits, and I put benefits in quotation marks, they ought to be exempted from the taxes. But let me say this though. You know, even if the government doesn't do that, my feeling is, as libertarians, what do we want to save the welfare state from these stresses and strains for? I mean, this may be the way to finally get the welfare state repealed, when Americans say, well, I don't want my tax money going to fund foreigners. I don't mind it to fund domestic Americans, but by golly, I don't want it to fund foreigners. Well, of course, they don't object to foreign aid, which is exactly that. But hey, I say if there's a way to get people to repeal the welfare state, open immigration may well be the way to do it. And finally, there's a lot of innocent immigrants that don't go on welfare. You know, where's the morality of punishing innocent people?
All right, FFF.org, y'all. Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here. Are you a libertarian and or peacenik? Live in North America? If you want, you can hire me to come and give a speech to your group. I'm good on the terror, war, and intervention, civil liberty stuff, blaming Woodrow Wilson for everything bad in the world, Iran, central banking, political realignment, and, well, you know, everything. I can teach markets to liberals and peace to the right. Just watch me. Check out scotthorton.org/speeches for some examples and email me scott@scotthorton.org for more information. See you there. All right, y'all. Welcome back to the show. Yeah, I'm a huddle masses guy. I don't care about the stats. I don't know if Jacob has the stats or not. I do know that Jacob has written a hell of a lot about immigration in the past. If you go and search at fff.org. And see what he's got there. But it's a lot. But yeah, nah, for me, it's just a human rights thing. And of course, we didn't even get a chance to talk about the fact that the reason that America is broke, the reason that the American people are broke, is because of the boom and the bust more than anything else. It's because of central banking and the malinvestment, phony prosperity, followed by very real crash cycle that keeps happening over and over and over again. And dislocating the economy and keeping real wages at 1978 levels when real productivity is up by 1,000,000%. Okay, I don't have my stats exactly right, but pretty damn close. And it's a god dang crying shame. And the reason why is because of government control of the money supply. Follow the money, dude. Okay, follow it all the way back to where it came from. The Fed had a bond made and then bought it. That's where the money came from. That's the source of your trouble. Follow the money. It's the Fed. It's that boom and bust. And they do it so that they make the wars seem free at first, so that they can get away with starting it. That's pretty much how it works. And so and then, of course, there's the drug wars and all the other wars of regime change and disruption. And for that matter, the boom and the bust cycle by the U.S. government is felt all over the world because the dollar is the reserve currency. And in fact, then they even say you have to buy our phony derivatives in order to enter into a trade agreement with us and this kind of thing, too. So they end up getting the whole damn world in on their giant Ponzi schemes. And then the boom is followed by the bust. And then people all over the world and in the East, they miss the Soviet Union. In South America, they embrace socialism. In the Middle East, they embrace revolution and dictatorship and suicide bombing. And in the West, they embrace fascism and socialism. Because of the boom and the bust. It ruins the whole damn world. And then you have the drug war, too. So down in Latin America, they got to deal with that. And by Latin America, I mean from Mexico all the way down on down. They got to deal with America's war on drugs. And nobody knows what the real numbers are, right? But it's something like 100,000 dead or, what, 60,000 dead, 70,000 dead or something in Mexico in the last few years from the drug wars. When everybody knows, right? It's reported all over in the Chicago Tribune and the New York Times and everything else that the CIA is in bed with the Sinaloa cartel. What? What about the Partnership for Drug-Free America? Oh, you just don't like the Zetas as much. And so, oh, okay. Yeah, the CIA in bed with the drug cartels, just like always and forever. It's like ever since at least the 60s, if not the 1880s, whatever, right? Oh, man. Well, so, yeah, I mean, this is the single most destructive force in Mexican society right now is the American drug war. The American mandated war on drugs, which doesn't get rid of drugs. It only turns the market over to criminals. And then it turns into a contest of who can be the most murderous criminal, because he's the guy that gets to win the black market and be the king of it all for a little while. You guys have seen The Wire. Well, that's the same way it works. Everywhere you create a black market with your stupid prohibition laws. And so, in Mexico, Calderon came to power, and it's so obvious, right? Isn't this what every single idiot on the Eastern Seaboard would have thought, too? You know what I'll do? I'll call out the military. Those gangsters may be tough, but they're no match for the Mexican army. Well, all he did was just escalate the crisis. The army was no more capable of wiping out the drug cartels than the police before them. But the drug cartels became militaries in their own right in response. And that many more people died when the metaphor, horrible enough, became an actual war. I mean, that's like, you know, the war against the Iraqi insurgency or something. 60,000 people killed, 100,000 people killed over cocaine and marijuana distribution rights? Oh, Jesus Christ. Oh, man, I wish these Mexicans would stop coming across the border. Yeah, it was that or get their head chopped off by the Zetas that your government made a problem for them. So give the kid a break, huh? America's a mean son of a bitch, man. Mean. Don't care at all, either. Even when the consequences are right in your face. I see this all the time on Twitter. People fight. Boy, the fights I stay out of on Twitter sometimes. Oh, I see the fights. You Mexican loving this and that. Well, all we need is a wall and a bunch of guards with machine guns and electric fences and Dobermans and Rottweilers and keep them goddamn Mexicans out. And then somebody says, man, what if we just stopped drug warring against them and destroying their entire society, and then they wouldn't be coming here in the first place? Oh, you're just on the side of the illegal immigrants. You know? Like, it's the invasion of the Mexican army. A bunch of refugees from America's government's policy. It's amazing. And anyway, so here you go. And, I mean, did anybody even bother asking the liberals? We know what the answer is. He's right. The liberals' answer is, well, Obama's doing it, so it's not that bad. I mean, come on, help me come up with excuses. By the way, the guy that commented in the chat room about what a fascist Obama is, I don't think that Jacob would have disagreed with that. But I think he was talking a bit more about, well, I don't know. He was pointing out the hypocrisy in their human rights-y stand. But I don't think that the fact that Obama makes him a fascist actually disqualifies him from all that touchy-feely humanitarian fascism, you know? He's a Lyndon Johnson kind of a guy. I don't think anybody's really calling that liberalism in an honest way, but since when has anybody called liberalism liberalism in an honest way? I mean, if the liberals were honest, they would call themselves socialists. I mean, the socialists are honest. They call themselves socialists. Why don't the liberals? And they agree with the socialists on everything. Anyway, even at Occupy, they said, well, of course we're for bailing out the banks because Isn't that what we're all supposed to think or something? I don't know if they had an argument. You want to bail out Citigroup? Wait, these are the worst people on the planet outside of the U.S. government. You want to bail out Citigroup? You've really thought this through nice and good. Oh, well, John McCain assures us the economy will crater. It'll crater. All right, anyway. I like Mexicans. I like the food of East Coast Mexicans a lot better than West Coast Mexicans. West Coast Mexicans, learn how to make Mexican food for crying out loud. You know, I lived in California for a couple of years, and Mexican food, as made by Mexicans in California, it's terrible. They put, like, soaking wet pot roast in their enchiladas, man. They put cilantro on everything. That's one of the main reasons I moved back to Texas, to tell you the truth. For the Mexican food. The Emergency Committee for Israel, Brookings, Heritage, APAC, WINEP, GINSA, PNAC, CNAS, the AEI, FPI, CFR, and CSP. It sure does seem sometimes like the war party's got the foreign policy debate in D.C. all locked up. But not quite. Check out the Council for the National Interest at councilforthenationalinterest.org. They put America first, opposing our government's world empire, and especially their Middle Eastern madness. That's the Council for the National Interest at councilforthenationalinterest.org. All right. Hey, I'm me. This is my show. Scott Horton's show. Coming up at the top of the hour, Nadia Kayali from the Electronic Frontier Foundation will be on. And Ray McGovern, her on NSA stuff, Ray on Iraq. Oh, good. All right. Let me tell you this. I need advertisers. I have some advertisers. I need more advertisers. So, if you have a business and you think that maybe you would like to give me some money in exchange for me talking about your business, or maybe your nonprofit group, or I don't know, whatever the hell. Well, email me. I'm scott@scotthorton.org. Maybe we can work something out, and you can advertise on the show, and then I can keep doing the show instead of not doing a show because I gotta go. I don't know what the hell I'm gonna go do. I know a guy who I think could give me a job selling couches, but I don't think I'd be a very good couch salesman. I always get fired from my retail jobs, you know, delivering pizza or whatever, dealing with customers, because I always call them horrible names to their face because I hate them so much. So I'm not really good for a job like that. I have to work on something. Maybe I could do data entry. If anybody's looking to hire somebody who could be taught how to do data entry, shoot me an email. Otherwise, advertise on the show. Those are your choices. Either hire me or advertise on the show. Somebody's got to pay the rent around here. And it's got to be me. Okay, good. All right. Yeah, Nadia Kayali and Ray McGovern coming up on the show. Now, man, there's so much to talk about. I want to talk about the cops here real quick before... Look, because Ray's going to be on to talk about Iraq. I mean, it's the biggest thing in the world, but... Well, got Ray to cover that, and some of this stuff has just got to be talked about, man. I gotta talk about it. It's Friday. So, police burst into wrong apartment, shoot innocent woman hiding in the closet. Well, she frightened them, or, you know, excuse. And then, in this one, the baby in Atlanta that the cops threw the flashbang grenade right into his crib and it exploded right in his face and destroyed one of his lungs and his face. The baby's still in a coma 3 weeks later. They're saying it looks like the lung is not going to heal and he's got a 50-50 chance of surviving. And they also talk about the father. They lied. They weren't the slightest bit sorry that they had thrown a grenade at the kid. They showed no remorse. They lied about the boy's injuries, saying, oh, well, he'd only lost a tooth. And then, quote, the officers cursed and yelled at us and threatened to arrest me after we expressed our concern for our son. He is still in a doctor-induced coma. I guess they're afraid if he was awake that it would kill him. The consciousness of what he's going through would be the end of him. This little toddler. The suspect wasn't there. There were no drugs, no illegal contraband of any kind in the house. The cops insist you pray for them. And in fact insist not only is it the fault of the guy who wasn't there and had no contraband there, who they later arrested on some probation violation or some nonsense, but actually, oh, he's a terrorist. Yeah, he's a terrorist. You know what? The guy that wasn't here, who didn't have anything, who wasn't even here when we threw a grenade at the baby, he's one of them terrorisms. Because he made us throw a grenade at his baby by, we accuse him of selling some meth to somebody who wanted it. What? These cops are pathetic. It's just ridiculous. No drugs found in the home, where the cop threw flashbang grenade into the baby's crib. Baby Bo still in a coma 3 weeks later. And I heard an anecdote, it was one of these articles about this, talked about how these same cops had been in trouble over flashbangs before it had come down to an argument in court where they said it is not a dangerous weapon at all. He said, fine, then you take one right now and go and put it in the jury box and detonate it. And we'll let the jury decide whether it's an explosive, whether it's a weapon, whether it's dangerous. And the prosecutor said, oh, huh, touche. Same thing happened during the Waco hearings when Bob Barr said, oh, okay. Yeah, flashbang's no big deal, huh? He brought some Play-Doh with him. He had the page hand the Play-Doh to the head of the ATF, Jim Cavanaugh. And he said, so, if that was a flashbang grenade whose pin had been pulled and it was in your hand, a live grenade, would you feel comfortable holding it in your hand? Oh, huh? Jeez. No, I guess not. Yeah, the same grenades they threw at women and children on the first day. The same grenades they started the fire with on the last day. Well, they lied. They committed the felony of perjury and pretended that the flashbang grenades that were left over from all three origins of the fire on the last day were silencers. Because, hey, look, a cylinder. Let's pretend it's a silencer. But the guys that made Waco a new revelation found them here in Austin at the DPS headquarters down there on Lamar. They went through the evidence. They finally got their hands on the evidence and went through and said, oh, silencers, huh? And these were all found here, here, and here. And anyway, so, yeah. That's what I tweeted to the Pope. Was, let's see somebody throw a flashbang grenade at your face in a SWAT raid in the middle of the night and then tell me how much you think that pot should be illegal. Stupid Pope. She'd tell me about the 50,000 dead people in Mexico over the last 10 years of drug war there, fighting over pot distribution rights, in large measure. What a pope. What a great pope. Anyway, so, all right, there's my cop and drug war stuff for the day. And then, here's a book review. The book review is about Unstoppable, the emerging left-right alliance to dismantle the corporate state. Ralph Nader, I guess, boy, that guy's got faith in the American system like I don't have. Unstoppable, huh? But man, I'm for this. From my very first day I ever did a radio show in 1998 on Free Radio Austin, I said the good part of the right, they believe in the Bill of Rights and keeping it, and in peace. And the good part of the left, them too. And libertarians, we're good on all this stuff. And so it's up to the libertarians to lead the good left and the good right toward a new realignment. The first thing we gotta do, end the empire. Well, first things we gotta do, end the empire, kick all the billionaires off welfare, and restore the Bill of Rights. All good conservatives, all good liberals, and all libertarians, good and bad, can agree on that stuff. And so that's good enough for a realignment. Why should it be that the coalitions have to be the Christian right and big businessmen and, you know, former communist Israeli warmongers or whatever? Why does that have to be the coalition? Why can't we have a real two-party system? The Democratic Republicans representing the people and the War Party representing Washington, D.C. and New York, where all they want to do is kill and steal all day. And then we'll have a sound dividing line, right? We'll have Hillary and Rand Paul run together on the same ticket. I mean, he would be on the good guy's side? I don't know. No, he would probably be on the bad guy's side if he thought he had 1% more chance of victory, you know. But anyway, I do want to see that realignment. Anyone could agree. Enough of the wars already. That's what the polls say. And anyone can agree. Why should billionaires get bailouts and welfare when everybody else has it rough? Screw them. Let Citigroup fail. Let it fall. Everybody can agree on that. All decent people agree about that. And the same thing for amendments 1 through, well, let's go ahead and make sure 1 through 13 for sure. That, yeah, go ahead and keep that. As long as we have a U.S. government, we get rid of the Bill of Rights last. Hey, all, Scott Horton here. It's always safe to say that one should keep at least some of your savings in precious metals as a hedge against inflation. And if this economy ever does heat back up and the banks start expanding credit, rising prices could make metals a very profitable bet. Since 1977, Robertson Roberts Brokerage, Inc. has been helping people buy and sell gold, silver, platinum, and palladium, and they do it well. They're fast, reliable, and trusted for more than 35 years. And they take Bitcoin. Call Robertson Roberts at 1-800-874-9760 or stop by rrbi.co. All right, you guys, welcome back. Well, so there was a time zone screw up with our next guest, unfortunately. Nadia Kayali was going to be on to talk about the fact that the House of Representatives passed an amendment last night restricting the spending of any money on the NSA's bulk collection program. Representative Thomas Massey and Representative Zoe Lofgren attached this thing and it got passed last night. It seems to be basically a replay of the Amash Amendment. I don't know if it's exactly the same, the one that failed last summer. Just barely failed last summer. And this one is straight to the power of the purse. It's not the USA Freedom Act. I don't know exactly what it is. Well, that's why I was going to ask her, because she's the expert lady who knows, but time zone problems, not available, unfortunately. We'll catch up with her next week, maybe. We're going to have Trevor Tim on, formerly of the Electronic Frontier Foundation, next week as well. I need to be better on this NSA stuff, man. But I'm busy and lazy. Lazy. I want to go back through and read every newspaper story in the entire EFF NSA index twice. I'm like, oh yeah, okay, now I can repeat this stuff like I know what the hell I'm talking about. You know what I mean? Learn a little bit better. That's my job. I'm behind the curve on it. I need to work on that for you. And by the way, if you want to work on it, it's just, you know, just type in EFF NSA, and of course they have an entire giant section. But if you click primary sources, it's also secondary sources. It's all the documents, but it's also all of each news story that went with each document release. So it's all there for you to read about. If you click on primary sources at the Electronic Frontier Foundation's NSA section, just with your Google search or whichever is your favorite search Just put in EFFNSA. It'll take you right to links to everything you need right there. So that's a hell of a good resource. All right, now, I don't know. There were a couple of new NSA stories. I guess this one is kind of funny. Keith Alexander wants to make $1 million a month. He wants to charge $1 million a month to go give, you know, briefings, basically, to go give a little talk in front of bank executives. You know, to tell them about cyber threats and to recommend courses of action. You know, not as any payback for anything he ever did for them when he was the NSA or anything. No, heaven forfend such favoritism that one would even imply that one would learn how to talk right, or imply that Keith Alexander is as corrupt as he is in violation of the law. Well, anyway, they're going to pay him. And what was it? Let me go and look at my Twitter here, because our old friend Jonathan Schwartz had a funny little thing he said here. I'll quote for you. Inside every fear-mongering NSA director is a grimy, small-time hustler trying to get out. Isn't that great? That's what I think, too. Grimy, small-time hustler. That's exactly what Keith Alexander is. The scum of the earth. The scum of the earth. All right, well, anyway. And then, now, so there's also some NSA news from the other day. I think it was from the other day. They're kind of minor stories. Let's see. One of them was they let the NSA employees kind of play games for how they search through all the material that they get as like a reward system to try to get them to do a good job. Which is, and then there was one about naming other countries besides the Five Eyes that help the Americans tap fiber optic cables all around the world. So that was kind of interesting, you know, nothing really like earth-shattering, but important for the record. And then what was the other one? There was another NSA story just the other day. Oh, that was it. NSA turned Germany into its largest listening post in Europe. The sixth eye there. All right. Well, anyway, so that was my NSA section. Unfortunately, sorry, guys, I'm not going to have Nadia Kayali here on the show. We had a time zone thing. She's on the West Coast, and I guess I should have known that and said Pacific time, but normally I just say Eastern, and I rely on people to count on their fingers back to -3. You know, it's not that hard. But these things happen. I screw it up too sometimes, so. Anyway. Ray McGovern coming up to talk about Iraq. There, I'll say that and keep you around for a little while longer. That's interesting. Yeah. I guess I'll get back to the Iraq news. You know, I guess one of the things that I'll ask Ray is whether he thinks this is all deliberately meant to drive maybe not just Maliki, but even the Shiite majority out of power in Baghdad to try to undo Bush's mistake. And that seems pretty grandiose for Obama. And after all, like I've been saying, broken recordly on the show lately, the reason 4,500 Americans died was, and the reason that approximately 1 million Iraqis died in the war there was because America was fighting on the majority Shiite side to kick all the Sunni Arabs out of Baghdad. And that sectarian cleansing took the entire U.S. Army and Marine Corps along with the Bada Brigade and the Mahdi Army to get the job done. And, you know, I just don't see how anybody can undo that without another full-scale invasion. I don't care how much money the Saudis pump into ISIS, into the former Ba'athists, and whatever. They're not going to be able to take back Baghdad. They may be able to bring down Maliki. They may be able to bring down the form of the government that the U.S. has created there. But are they going to be able to take back the capital city? I mean, I guess it used to sort of kind of be a 50-50 affair, but the Sunnis still had all the power, and the Shiites still mostly were in Sadr City, which is, you know, a suburb, a part of eastern Baghdad, which is, you know, almost entirely Shiite, but it's now 85% Shiite city, so who's going to be able to reduce, you know, reverse that? But bring down Maliki, again, same as Assad, right? Not necessarily overthrow him, but take him down a peg, weaken Iran's position a little bit. I know it's crazy, but maybe that should be the beginning assumption. Well, what would be crazy and nonsensical for them to do? Still, they treat Iran like an enemy all this time. You would think, well, I guess not. It makes more and more sense the more I think about it. I was going to say, you would think the Americans could be a good sport and say, you know what, we were dumb enough to fall for it and fight a war for you against Saddam and put your guys in power. Hardy har har, you got us. And be cool with that instead of turn around and trying to reverse it and killing who knows how many more people. But as long as I put it that way, then I think that, no, the answer must be, obviously, the American government is doing the least sportsmanlike thing possible in any given situation, and this is one. So backstab the Shia and redirect this thing for real? Why not? Hey, y'all, Scott here. So you made a little bit of money in this horrid economy, only to find that the Fed has more or less outlawed saving. So into the treacherous waters of the stock market bubble you go. But how to make a little money without too much risk of losing it all? Check out WallStreetWindow.com. Mike Swanson is a successful former hedge fund manager who opens a very real window into his main account, updating his subscribers on the facts of and the reasoning behind all his market moves. Follow along on paper or with real money and see what happens at WallStreetWindow.com. Well, that's funny. Somebody on Twitter is claiming, although they don't seem to be linking to the evidence for it, that apparently the ISIS guys, they claim, are sending this picture of them standing with John McCain around. It's the Northern Storm Brigade, part of ISIS now. These very same individuals posing with John McCain in the picture from last year in Syria. I told you guys that... a million times I said it, that John McCain went over there and met with the Northern Storm Brigade, which was accused of, and I don't think it was the exact members he's standing with, but the same group had been accused, and I believe rightfully, of kidnapping 12 Shiite pilgrims from Lebanon who had come to a shrine or something like that. And but they were just civilians, you know. It's not like they were all secretly Hezbollah fighters or whatever. They were just civilian pilgrims. And these guys had captured them and ransomed them, so they were terrible criminals. And that got the headline. But if you just Google Northern Storm Brigade, the first thing you find is Time Magazine interviewing these same guys. And they're saying, yeah, we're veterans of the Iraq War. You know, so just rewind to the Iraq War. Any Syrians that went to fight against the Americans on the side of the Sunni-based insurgency, those were called Al-Qaeda in Iraq. That's who they were, AQI. They were fighting presumably under the, at least, you know, certainly in the American narrative, any foreigners fighting there with the Sunni insurgency were under the banner of Al-Qaeda, under the banner of Zarqawi's group. Certainly John McCain would have said so. And here he was standing there posing with him, and Elizabeth Obagi, who you might remember pretended to be a PhD and was, you know, a paid activist for the Syrian rebels and all this, and ended up getting fired from Fatneck Fred Kagan's wife's think tank, the Institute for the Study of War. She bragged to the Daily Caller. This was no scoop. This was no anonymous source. This was the lady who helped John McCain and his staff set up this meeting. She explained to Politico that McCain wanted to have a pajama party, wanted to have a sleepover at the house with the Northern Storm Brigade. And yet his security detail insisted that, no, we've got to leave, Senator. What are you talking about? These are the moderates. AQI guys. So when this Twitterer claims that ISIS is sending this around, and they're claiming to be the individuals in this picture with John McCain, wouldn't surprise me one bit. You know? They said the Al-Farouk Brigade, now those guys, they really rejected all this Bin Ladenite stuff. They wanted to have elections and respect all the different sects, you know, keep separation of church and state. Oh yeah, it was their leader that was on video eating a dead soldier's heart. These are the moderates America's been backing in Syria this whole time. And it is not plausible deniability when the Saudis and the Qataris are financing it the whole time and the Americans are not stopping them. When the Americans and the Jordanians and the Turks are working together to train up the FSA and send them into combat with all this money and all these weapons that for now 3 years on end have wound up in the hands of al-Nusra and ISIS. And come on. I got to be wearing a hole in your eardrum saying the same damn pattern of sounds over and over again. Moderates don't fight in holy wars. The guys that are fighting on the ground in Syria right now, they're extremists. They're true believers. They're the suicide bombers and the prisoner beheaders, those who crucify their enemies in the town square to show what savages they are. What terrorists they are. Moderates. The moderates are 1% of the insurgency doing the fighting over there. Otherwise, a moderate is an extremist saying, yes, CIA, thank you very much for the money and the weapons. Just take the contrary position for a moment. If Barack Obama's policy was, we want to do everything we can to stop Al-Qaeda from gaining anything in Syria, he would have backed Assad. He certainly would have told the Saudis, hey, knock off with your financing of these crazies. He hadn't done that. This is not at all plausible deniability. That's what it is. Well, what we do is we have the Saudis ship all the money and then we give it to the FSA and then the FSA gives it to the Nusra and the ISIS. There you go. Go read the Long War Journal. Which is, I think, from Kimberly Kagan's think tank, right? Isn't that right? The Institute for the Study of War, don't they sponsor the Long War Journal? And they say, hey, look, y'all, we give anti-tank missiles to the Free Syrian Army, and immediately they end up in the hands of the al-Nusra Front, the so-called Islamic Front, which is just the cash and weapons receiving arm of the al-Nusra Front. And anyway, now the Nusra Front and ISIS are at odds now, but they're exactly the same. They're only fighting about who's in charge. They're dividing up the labor of who's fighting what. Basically, now that ISIS is a place and not just the name of a group, I guess you could say that al-Nusra is in charge of fighting on its Western Front against the state formerly known as Syria. Something like that. Anyway, so the question is, when they send these advisors in, what's the deal? They already say they want rid of Maliki. Do they really want another real regime change in Baghdad? Is America going to keep sponsoring ISIS in Iraq, turn their drones and their bombs on the Iranians, helping the Shiites stab them in the back? Nothing more dangerous than being friends of the USA, man. How about that? Another million dead? Another 8-year war for Baghdad? Who's ready? And all what? Because the Iranians overthrew the American-backed dictator in 1979 and the Americans can't get over it. Oh, and because that's what Israel wants. because Israel's pretend to be scared of their pretend nukes that they're not making over there. It's a sound policy. You can see. No, I don't know. I think, you know what? They were fighting a war for the Iranians, and all through 2007, they pretended they were fighting against them. All through 2007, they pretended that every roadside bomb must have been an Iranian bomb. They had no evidence for it whatsoever. It's completely ridiculous. And Patrick Coburn and others were reporting all along about the machine shops where they were making the EFPs were found all over Iraq. And yeah, they were being used by the Shiites as well as the Sunnis, but they were all indigenous. And the only evidence they ever, the only argument they ever even came up with was just that they must be. The implication that being that Arabs are too stupid to put copper in the core of their bomb, only a sophisticated Persian super criminal could think of putting copper in their bomb. And anyway, so is the U.S. capable of fighting a war for Iran and Iran's interests in Iraq at the same time that they're fighting against them? Yeah. They did it in 07. Why not do it again? Hey, y'all, Scott here for MyHeroesThink.com. They sell beautiful 7-inch busts of libertarian heroes Ludwig von Mises, Murray Rothbard, Ron Paul, and Harry Brown. These finely crafted statues from MyHeroesThink.com make excellent decorations for your desktop at work, bookends for your shelves, or gifts for that special individualist in your life. They're also all available in colors now, too. Of course, gold, silver, or bronze. Coming soon, Hayek, Hazlitt, Carlin. Use promo code Scott Horton and save $5 at MyHeroesThink.com. All right, y'all. Welcome back to the show. And I had to bump Ray McGovern for just a minute because I got Patrick Coburn live on the phone from Baghdad, Middle East correspondent for The Independent at independent.co.uk. Welcome back to the show, Patrick. How are you doing?
Pretty good.
Good, good. Thank you very much for joining us. So, tell us, what do you see? What's important? What do we need to know?
Well, it's Baghdad is a sense of people are pretty frightened after the big advances by the Islamic State of Iraq and the Levant, ISIS, the Al-Qaeda-type organization that's taken Mosul and most of the north of the country. And they're sort of they're just about an hour's drive to the north of Baghdad, sort of in a semicircle. Baghdad's a big city, about 7 million people. Not clear, it's mostly Shia. The insurgents are almost are entirely Sunni. So it's not clear if they're going to attack. But the government is sort of talking about a big offensive here. I kind of believe it when I see it. The government here is sort of dysfunctional in a very real sense. I mean, we use the word dysfunctional, meaning not very efficient, but this is a government which just does not function. I mean, it's in the past, it sort of hasn't been able to get food to its own troops. Troops are sent to the front line with 4 magazines for their guns, which they shoot off in about 3 minutes, and there's no more for them. What's happened here is really a Sunni revolt. There are about 5 or 6 million Sunni in Iraq, in the north and center. And the shock troops of this revolt are the Al-Qaeda-type Islamic State people. Very efficient, very fanatical, very well-led, extremely violent, cruel. They executed 1,700 Shia prisoners. But they've been the shock troops of a sort of much wider uprising by the Sunni against Nouri al-Maliki, the prime minister, who they see as the oppressor, the guy who's discriminated against them, the guy who prevented them getting jobs, the guy who put their sons in jail. They're said to be about 100,000 people in jail here. Many of them never been brought to trial. Many of them just held on suspicion. Quickest way of getting out of prison is to pay a very large bribe. And to get a bribe is often the reason people went into prison. ISIS in Mosul has started destroying statues of Islamic philosophers. They don't believe in commemorating any of these people. So They haven't quite implemented the full Sharia law yet of stopping women going out without a close relative. But most of the minorities, Christians and others, have already fled. So now we'll wait and see. Will this sort of coalition of Sunnis stay together? Will it fall apart? Will they attack Baghdad? Will the U.S. or Iran come in? Mm-hmm. So everything is on edge here, and nothing, any of these things could happen.
Right. Now, yeah, lots of go back over there. Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No, you go on.
Oh, well, okay. So on the question of whether they're going to take Baghdad or not, this is something that you and I have discussed for years, was really what led to the ceasefire more than anything was, you know, back in 08, I guess late 07, 08, was that the Americans had helped the Shiite militias really kick all the Sunnis out of Baghdad and make it a super majority, 85% Shiite city. And at that point, the Sunni insurgency leaders basically decided they needed a ceasefire to lick their wounds and get their act back together again. And at that point, convinced Petraeus to go ahead and pay them and arm them and allow them to patrol their own neighborhoods if they would stop attacking the U.S. if the U.S. would stop attacking them, as they had already lost. But so then the question was whether they can take Baghdad back or whether they think they can. And we've talked about this numerous times since then. I think you've said that there are indications, at least, that they think that they can retake Baghdad, even if it took the U.S. Army and Marine Corps to give it to the Shia, that they're the super majority. They got Saudi money and now they've got their own kind of proto-state, and why leave well enough alone if they can get back the capital city? So I wonder whether you think they're really going to try to attack. And then I guess also wonder whether you think that the Shia, you know, fighting-age males are going to rally to Maliki's government, or are they just going to rally to their local militias to fight?
Well, they've been sent into the army. You know, there was a fatwa from the Grand Ayatollah Ali Sistani on, I think, Thursday, calling them for people to join the army. See, a lot of volunteers going into the army, but they're often not trained. I mean, these people may have, they're not used a gun much, except to fire pistols at their weddings. And also, you know, what applies to the regular army applies to them. If they couldn't, the government couldn't supply the regular army with ammunition and food, is it going to be able to supply these volunteers? So it might be an advantage to the government to have this great mass of armed men, but it's very much like a sort of armed crowd. You know, could Baghdad fall? Well, it might. I mean, Baghdad is mostly Shia, as you said, but around the edges, on every side, it's sort of encircled by Sunni towns and Sunni areas. And morale is kind of pretty fragile at the moment here. So if the army broke and ran at Mosul without any much fighting, it might do the same down here. Of course, one could say they were defending their own co-religionists down here, so they might fight harder. But I'd kind of like to see some evidence of that.
Yeah. Well, now, so it's a seeming, from here, it seems like, you know, pretty close to a stalemate where the Iraqi army, I guess, it remains to be seen, like you're saying, whether they can hold on to Baghdad. But it makes more sense why they wouldn't even really try to hang on to Mosul in the face of stiff resistance if the Iraqi army is basically just the Badr Brigade dressed up in American uniforms, right? But it does make sense that they'd fight like hell for the territory that they have actually won for themselves. At the same time, it doesn't seem like the Sunnis are going to be able to advance into Baghdad or much further south or east than that. So I wonder whether, you know, they're already kind of at stalemate and whether maybe both sides could begin to recognize that instead of having a worse and worse war.
Yeah, I think we're a bit off. It may turn out like that, but I think we haven't reached that. First of all, the Sunnis, ISIS, the Islamic State, feel that this, you know, they've won these terrific victories, that this is God-given, so God is on their side, so they may keep going. They may not want the other side to draw breath. Secondly, they're pretty well organized, I think, by former senior officers and officers in Saddam, Special Republican Guard and security forces. What they tend to do is sort of take a town and then they don't leave their best fighters there. They sort of leave a sort of local Sunni gunman to hold the place, and they sort of they want to keep their sort of strike force together so they can launch these sort of blitzkrieg attacks. So yeah, in any when you calculate it, they shouldn't be able to take Baghdad, but it's mostly Sunni because there's a big army, because there's loads of militia. But as I said, you know, the joker in the pack here is the Iraqi government, you know, which is shows itself sort of to reaching new heights of incapacity every week. Mm-hmm. And it's sort of more like a large sort of racket than a government. You know, it really was pretty extraordinary 10 days ago that the senior commanders of this very large army simply change into civilian clothes and flee, you know.
And what was behind that, by the way, Patrick? Because it sure seems like a million to one kind of a ratio, or what, a thousand to one ratio, literally, of soldiers.
Well, it's, you know, it comes down to the nature of the Iraqi army that, you know, it's just kind of a money-making machine for the officers. What would happen, I was talking to a retired general about this. He was saying to what happened, I said, you know, why did it fall apart? And he said, look, just corruption, corruption, corruption. And all the if you were a captain or had any officer, you bought your job. And what you would do, for instance, actually, this is the Americans slightly responsible for this, that they outsource supplies of food for the army. So commercial companies were supplying it. But, you know, an Iraqi battalion is meant to be 600 men, but in fact, they usually be about 200 men. So the officer in command will be pocketing food for 400 men over the year, which is a lot of money. So because you can make a lot of money out of these jobs, then people bid for them. So it'd be $10,000 to become a captain, then it'd be 20, then it'd be 50, you know, it'd be a colonel, maybe it'd be a couple of $100,000. And then they'd make it back once they'd taken their jobs. So they weren't actually in the army to fight. It was more of an investment for them. Right. So, you know, I don't think there'd be many armies like this. You know, you had ghost battalions, you know, I've heard of that sort of thing in the old South Vietnamese army. But a lot of the Iraqi army was just made up of these ghost battalions, that there may be men whose names were down in the roster being part of the battalion, but maybe they'd never existed. And the commanders were taking their pay and their food and everything else. Or you could do another thing, was you join the army and then you got as a private soldier, and then you kick back half your salary to the officer above you, and then you never go near the barracks, so you never actually put on a uniform, although you're still drawing half your military salary. You're drawing the whole thing, but you have kicked back half of it. So that's the way it works.
Right.
So, as you can imagine, this does not produce a very effective fighting machine.
Right. Well, now, so you reported, and I believe the way that you wrote it here in the Independent, Patrick, is that you have sources there in Iraq that have informed you that Obama has insisted that Maliki must go in order for the Iraqi government to get the help. Is that right? Because the Wall Street Journal was reporting that same thing from the American side over here.
Yeah, the two stories seem to coincide. I'm very certain on this, that they were telling senior people here, look, you know, this is, we're not going to go in and be the saviors of a sectarian government under, you know, a guy we regard as a sectarian Shia prime minister, Nouri al-Maliki. You know, that kind of happened before. So if we're going to give aid, there has to be a sort of national reconciliation government, which is brings in important Sunni and so forth, but it isn't just basically a Shia government. And Maliki is the sort of symbol of that, so there's no way they're going to do that while Maliki's there. It's actually a pretty reasonable attitude. Otherwise, you know, they come in and there's some airstrikes and Maliki survives and then the situation gets worse.
Well, you know,
Maliki is kind of the hate figure for the Sunni. And, you know, you have a sort of very different people who are following the sort of ISIS, the al-Qaeda types, as shock troops, basically because they're so alienated by the government down here.
Right. Well, I mean, the thing is, to watch Obama talk about it and say, hey, listen, you know, the Iraqi government, they're going to have to start compromising and including the Sunnis in the government, all this. And he's basically talking like Petraeus in 2007. These are the benchmarks that the surge never did accomplish, the compromises in politics that never did happen. And now that the suicide bombers are in the lead and the entire West is declaring independence and may invade the capital city, now he's saying, well, you know, you better compromise. You better start appointing some Sunnis to some of your top cabinet positions. And if not Maliki, somebody else needs to come in here and start meeting these benchmarks. And I'm just pointing at the calendar and saying that this ship sailed a long time ago, back when they failed in the first place.
Well, sure, yeah. I remember Maliki was an American creation. He was an American appointee by Colonel Dodd, when his ambassador here.
By the way, your brother Andrew has a great piece about him at harpers.org this week, about how he picked Maliki.
Yeah, no, that's great. Andrew told me about it. And, you know, so he's an American appointee. It eventually sort of kind of became under the influence of Iran, but it was kind of Iran and the U.S. who were responsible for this guy. He was a guy who sort of got on with both of them. And 2010, he sort of did badly in the election, and there was a lot of sort of wrangling, but eventually the U.S. and Iran both ended up by supporting his reelection, and, you know, which has been pretty disastrous. And so, you know, it's all pretty late in the day. Of course, what changed all the calculations here was the uprising in Syria. And, you know, I don't think people have quite thought ahead yet, but I mean, this kind of extraordinary situation that the U.S. will be supporting the opposition in Syria, which if it effectively is dominated and even more dominated by ISIS, well, it's threatening to bomb ISIS in Iraq, you know. Mm-hmm. So it's really by supporting the rebellion in Syria that they destabilized Iraq. It should have been pretty obvious that they were doing this, but I think they believed a lot of their own propaganda. Maybe they didn't care that somehow the opposition in Syria was very different from the opposition in Iraq. But actually, they're kind of the same kind of guys.
Well, now, I guess regime change might be too far, but then again, regime change seems too far in Syria, too. Is it possible that the policy is not stupid, that the policy is simply to take Maliki and the United Iraqi Alliance, or whatever they call it now, down a peg, the same way they're working on taking Assad down a peg? They don't ever give the opposition enough firepower to really overthrow him, but enough to keep him bogged down. And after all, fighting a war for Iran in Iraq for 8 years was a big, dumb mistake, right? So they got to start trying to reverse it somehow at some point.
It might be that, or it might be just sort of, you know, they kind of lost it, you know. They sort of, I don't think Washington wants to get back, or Obama wants to get back into Iraq, and that's kind of a sensible thing to do.
Yeah, but, I mean, resent Iranian influence in Iraq and try to degrade that by propping up some ISIS crazies for a while. Why not?
I doubt it, because there's so many negatives. I mean, remember, these are incredibly dangerous guys who will, you know, these guys are quite capable of staging attacks anywhere in the U.S. or any other places, and they're extremely effective. So I think it's sort of more a sort of fantastic miscalculation, rather like the original invasion of Iraq. You know, one could go with various conspiracy theories, but I don't really go down that road. I think it's just sort of a massive miscalculation in Syria, destabilized Iraq again, which should have been fairly obvious, but it wasn't obvious to Washington, wasn't obvious to London or Paris or these other places.
So when Obama says he's sending the special forces to go and lead missions, they're not going to fight, but they're going to help fight, whatever that means. I mean, he even said part of the policy is we have to deny them safe havens. So that sounds to me like if he's not going to send in the Marines, it must mean fleets of drones or something, right?
Well, they might, yeah. I mean, it's sort of, I think they probably also want to find what's going on here, you know. They discovered the sort of information they were getting on the army here, you know, was completely inaccurate. It's very difficult to know here because it's such a state of chaos, you know. And so I think they probably want to know the real situation. The crucial thing is, I suppose, here, that can they genuinely cooperate with the Iranians? And will that be part of a general new arrangement with the Iranians? If they can't do that, then it's going to be very difficult, right, because they'll still be sort of competing with the Iranians here. So I think that, you know, I think that they're caught by this sort of disastrous consequences of their policy in Syria, and that in sort of reinfecting Iraq. So what was seen to be settled 3 or 4 years ago turns out not to be settled. But I think that was it was miscalculation, not conspiracy.
Yeah. All right. Well, so now if they were able to convince Maliki to step aside, who's there? I mean, I saw their meeting with Ahmed Chalabi, but that just can't be that they would even try that. So let's put that off at least for the moment. What about Iyad Alawi, who, you know, he has done fairly well.
He might be
done fairly well in some of these elections.
He
seems a bit more
broad. It might be somebody called Tariq Najm, who used to be chief of staff to Maliki. I think Maliki, if he can't keep the job himself, will try and keep it sort of in his own party. He'll try and sort of be like Putin used to be with his prime minister Medvedev, the power behind the throne. But I don't think anybody's buying that. But he'll try and do that. This guy called Tariq Najm was his chief of staff. The other thing about Maliki, to remember, it's his extended family. It's a bit like Saddam, who sort of held power and held all the, you know, made all the decisions. So if he's finally sort of driven out, what he'll want is a kind of guarantee that he doesn't get pursued. You know, that his all the money that he's got isn't taken away from. It's a bit, I mean, cast your mind back to sort of Yeltsin in Russia, you know, that there was kind of a deal that when he finally left power, that he and his family wouldn't be pursued, and the millions that they'd stolen wouldn't be taken back.
Yeah. All right. Scott, I'm sorry.
I've got to go. I'm afraid.
No, that's okay.
But
thank you very much for your time,
you,
Patrick. I appreciate it.
All the best. Bye-bye.
All right, that's Patrick Coburn, everybody, from The Independent. That's independent.co.uk, and they reprint it all at uns.com as well. You can find it there. And let's see the latest. I had it here. It's, Iraq crisis. U.S. precision attacks will hurt the jihadis but won't defeat them. Yeah, I got that right. And, yeah, all right, anyway. Well, so I was going to ask him about the religious aspects of the war and how, you know, beyond sectarianism, it seems like part of the problem now is the people who really are the most religious kooks are coming to the fore, and you start seeing people killing each other for being heretics, as he did mention there, defacing and destroying Shiite shrines, the ISIS guys are. This is the kind of thing people fighting over now, who's a blasphemer and who's not, and this kind of crap that can... Well, it just becomes another pile of perverse incentives for people to keep acting wrong, right? People just hate heretics for some reason. They just can't stand that somebody would disagree with them. Oh, no, nobody ever disagrees with you just because they think you're wrong. There's something really bad behind it, like the CIA or the KGB or Satan or something. Couldn't possibly be that anybody just thinks you're an idiot. So, here you got these ISIS guys, and this has been the case since Zarqawi's days. They're perfectly happy to blow up a Shiite shrine if they can get that many people to join up the war against them. That's how terrorism works. Let's make things worse for now until we really win and get the goals that we're really out to achieve there. That's the theory. And it can work too well, as the Sunni-based insurgency found out that, I don't know. Maybe Zarqawi was right after all. I think they were pissed, though, that they lost Baghdad. The Sunnis were pissed that... Zarqawi was basically the number one recruitment poster for the Badr Brigades for the Iraqi army back then, for those who would resist them, and ended up losing that battle. But now look at them. They might have Shias stand in the south and the east, but they've got jihadis stand in the west. And you know, I gotta tell you, I got bad news for you, is that, yeah, we're doomed. Because the thing of it is that I was watching an anti-war lady on TV this morning arguing with a pro-war guy. And he's saying, we gotta do something. And she was good. And she was saying, listen, you can't just say that there's a possible threat. That's how we got into this war in the first place. There's a possible threat, so we got to go do something about it. Now you're telling me there's a possible threat, so we got to go do something about it. And all I'm saying is, she may be speaking for the super-duper majority of the American people on this issue. And she may have been making a really good point. I mean, it would have been better if she had, like, jabbed her finger in the air and said, you don't start a war. Ever. But the point is, she did good, but she lost, because this guy said, but the threat is so serious. And Obama accepted every premise of the danger yesterday, but promised 1/10 of the war that's really coming. So, I don't know, man. Call your congressman for what it's worth. Gareth has been to Iran and Israel. I'm going to interview him Sunday on KPFK. Check it out. Anti-war radio in the morning there.